Good evening, everyone. Good evening. Thanks so much for coming out this evening to our third Writers Read event of 2014-15. This is a wonderful, diverse audience of people representing students and graduate students, undergraduate students, faculty, staff, folks from the community. We really appreciate your attendance tonight and your interest in this particular topic and presentation. Since we were expecting a bigger crowd than usual tonight, we moved from Common Grounds here to Streight Conference Room. But the Common Grounds staff have arranged for refreshments to be available. If your neighbors don't mind you crawling out over them during the presentation, you could go back and help yourself at any time you like. Or if you're in one of those prime seats over there on the end, then you don't have any problem. As you entered, you may have noticed, I think we have baskets at the two doors here. If anybody feels moved to give a donation to help us defray some of the costs of our event. I want to say a special thank you this evening to Joan Chamberlain, the office coordinator for Language and Literature, who handled all these arrangements for the setup tonight and deals with the authors who come with their transportation and lodging arrangements and all of that. Thanks, Joan, for your very efficient and detail-oriented work on that. I also want to thank Marty King for being here tonight to tape the event. If your colleague or friend wanted to be part of this and hear this and is not able to, Marty is going to turn this into DVDs. There will be one probably in the library as early as Monday. Our department also gets a copy if you want to. If you can't borrow the libraries, you can talk to Joan or me about getting the copy from our department. And finally, I want to thank two people who, in the midst of a very busy semester, have made time to give formal responses tonight to our author's talk, and that's Eric Cotting, the Director of Residence Life and Associate Dean of Students here at EMU, and Heidi Winters-Vogel, Professor of Theater. So following about a 25-minute presentation by our author, Eric and Heidi will each give a short response, and then we'll throw it open to discussion involving everyone. So I'm sure already you have already turned off your electronic devices so that they don't disturb other people around you, and they don't disturb you, your attention from the presentation. And following our time of discussion, tonight, Mark will be available here to sign books. Two of the books that he has authored are here at the table. And that would be nice if you had a little cash. He sells them at cost, so he's not making any money off of these particular books here. And you're welcome to get an autograph and to talk to him more personally at that time. So now it's my pleasure to introduce in a little bit more detail Mark Bauerlein, our author for the night. Some of you have read this book by Nicholas Carr, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. This is the book that was nominated as the Common Read here at EMU this academic year. Many people have read it, and we have been considering how the internet is shaping or influencing our behaviors, our thinking, our research, the way we read or don't read, and so forth. In November, as some of you will remember, we had two lectures related to this topic, one by Dr. Siva Vaidyanathan from UVA about the Googleization of everything and why we should worry. That was sponsored by the History Department's KIME lectures. And then sponsored by the provost office, we had Dr. Dan Willingham, also of the University of Virginia, speaking on when can you trust the experts? And now tonight, in the third, I think, and final event that's related to the Common Read this year, it's my pleasure to present Dr. Mark Bauerlein. Sorry. He's the author of two books related to the topic, and one of them is The Dumbest Generation, Some of you have seen that title or heard that title before. The other one is The Digital Divide. That's a book that Mark has introduced and collected an anthology of readings about, I'm not sure exactly what the content of the book is, but I'm buying it after the meeting tonight so that I can read it because it looks interesting. I explored it a little bit on Amazon. I believe that Nicholas Carr is among the authors who has an essay in that book, and perhaps some other people. Is Willingham in there also or not?
Not Willingham.
Not Willingham. Okay. Well, some of you came out tonight purely because of the topic. Other ones, other of you may have come because you heard some good things about Mark Bauerlein, that he's a professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And this is a school that has somewhat of a stress on graduate education. He was telling me that they have 5,000 undergraduate students, but they also have 5,000 graduate students. Mark, however, prefers working with undergraduate students and mainly teaches in the undergraduate program and even enjoys teaching college writing. Figure that. in addition to his scholarly publications in his field, which is American literature, he is also a prolific essayist for a number of important journals, including the Chronicle of Higher Education and First Things, a prominent journal of religion and public life. And he's also given some of himself back to public life as an assistant director for research in the National Endowment for the Arts during the George W. Bush administration, or part of that time anyway. His presentation tonight, then, in keeping with our common read theme, will explore the effects of the digital age on the humanities. Welcome, Mark Bauerlein.
All right. It's great to be here and to talk really coming out of this book, The Dumbest Generation. The full title is The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. And I was going to put my wife there in the dedication. She said, please don't put my name on this book. So, you know, anyway. One guy introduced me to a crowd and said, this is one book that managed to insult 93 million Americans just with the title. So let me clarify. The digital age and intellectual problems with youth who are so immersed in it, the digital natives. That doesn't mean that the digital youth are, in terms of just basic intelligence or motivation or ambition, any worse than they were when I was a kid. No, that's not it. In fact, young people have many better measures these days. More of them are going to college. They take more AP courses. They have more professional degree aspirations. There are better behavioral measures out there regarding attitudes toward parents, for instance, and rates of violent crime and illegitimacy. Those have gone down. But the place where I focus here is, and this is roughly the thesis, is that digital tools in the hands of the young generally, not necessarily, but generally serve an anti-intellectual purpose. And the reason is not because the tools themselves are essentially anti-intellectual. We know these tools can be instruments of knowledge. They deliver more information, more history, more art, more great music, more high culture, more maps, geography, all the known knowledge than ever before. It's miraculous what they can do for young people. They are intellectual tools, but that really is not the primary meaning that these tools have for teenagers and early 20-year-olds. The primary meaning they have, and this is nothing profound here, is social. These tools mostly serve the purpose of connecting youth to other youth. They immerse young people in youth culture. They allow peer-to-peer contact at all times of the day, in all places. You can conduct a social life in your bed at midnight. You can conduct a social life in the back seat of your parents' car on Highway 81, far from any city. And that this is the potential of these tools to extend youth culture, peer pressure, peer-to-peer contact, extends youth culture, which by and large is anti-intellectual, anti-historical, anti-eloquence. That's the issue, that we have so much youth communication circulating. We don't have the kinds of adult, grown-up, larger world, intellectual world coming into young people's lives the way it used to, more than it does now. Okay, and there's some other developments there. For instance, the rise of cable TV was part of this process in the 1980s. Back in the old days, when I was 17, there were only, well, how many TV, let me ask the young people, how many TV stations were there when I was your age? You guys know? There were five. There were the three main networks. If you were like, because in some places there might be only three or four. They had VHF and UHF. Those are signs out of the past. Or sometimes you had something called rabbit ears, you guys. And sometimes you'd have to. My father would say, "Mark, get up there and hold it, because if someone's touching it, the snow goes away." I say, "Oh God." You had to get up and walk over and turn a dial to change the channel. There was no clicker. So this is all part of that whole amazing threshold that we've passed through in the 80s and 90s. Anyway, when you only had those number of channels, the youth offerings on television were quite limited. And there were hardly any shows that had teenagers in them. I once looked up in Atlanta in 1970 on an April afternoon. What could you watch? You went home at 3 o'clock, and there was The Secret Storm, General Hospital, and One Life to Live. No, there were no teenagers in those. This was before the Luke and Laura era, you guys. General Hospital, if you got it. Anyway, and then you had Rocket Robin Hood, which was a cartoon for five-year-olds. And then you had a talk show. I think it was the Mike Douglas or Merv Griffin, one of these talk shows. And I looked through the whole day. There was only one program all day long that had a teenager in it. It was called the Patty Duke Show. And that was opposite Walter Cronkite that day, the CBS News. We had TV shows that teenagers liked, like Gilligan's Island or My Favorite Martian. There weren't teenagers in those shows. There were no teenage characters in them. So we couldn't come home and be surrounded by people in our age group. We had to break out of it. That's just an example. Now you can go on cable and there are a dozen shows with teenagers or 30-year-olds playing teenagers in high school in fantasy versions, right, of teenagers. But so now what the digital tools have done is allow young people to be surrounded at all times with youth-to-youth communication, youth culture. 3,500 text messages a month on average, sending or receiving, for teenagers who have a mobile device. That's where we were at a year ago, according to Nielsen. 9 hours of media per day, according to Kaiser Foundation, in 6 hours of leisure time. And what they do is they calculate, okay, I'm surfing the web while the TV's on. So it's the multitasking, multimedia. So it's the immersion in all these digital streams, screens coming in, delivering, again, the text messages, the youth music, the youth celebrity websites, the youth TV shows, and the gossip and images and everything else. So that is really the basic contention in that Dumbest Generation book. So let me quickly turn this to the humanities. And this area of intellectual growth, intellectual development. Now, the humanities is the critical study of ideas and creations, right? Philosophy, poetry, music, the critical study of them. Not the creation of them, that's the fine arts area, but the critical and historical analysis of these things. Why do we do it? Why bother? I mean, why don't we just consume poetry? Why don't we just take music in and enjoy it? You know, you go to a movie with your friends, you walk out, and you start analyzing it, and your friends say, you know, can't we just enjoy this without you ruining everything? So, you know, students will say, they'll love, you know, these movies like, what's the movie? The Kids Goes Back in Time. Michael J. Fox. Back to the Future. Back to the Future was written by some guys who read Freud very carefully. They recast the Oedipal romance in a comical way. And you present that to students, and they say, what are you talking about? But it all fits. It's actually very clever. The way they did that. But that would be a humanistic understanding of that film. It's more than just consumption. But why bother? Okay? What is the motivation for that? The motivation is that there are certain kinds of experiences that we have with certain objects that aren't quantifiable. They're not even entirely explicable. They aren't necessarily moral either. We don't take these objects and say that's good or that's evil. We don't take these objects that we encounter, and I'm going to clarify what I mean, and say about them, oh, that's very interesting, that's, and then we explain it. Instead, we have, well, is called an aesthetic experience of them. And the aesthetic experience is when you're walking through a museum and you go, okay, and then suddenly you see a painting and it grabs you, right? You're arrested by it. You stop. You look at it. And you contemplate it. It gives you some kind of pleasure. But the pleasure is more of a kind of reflective kind. And what do you say about it? Oh, that's beautiful, right? That experience makes that object really important to you. You're not even sure why it's important. You can't will this to happen. You can't say to yourself, I'm going to look at that painting and I'm going to love it. No, you look at it and you either love it or you don't. And the thing is that object becomes significant, and you want to stick with it. You want to see it again. You're drawn to it. Okay? It becomes a powerful experience. It could be something you listen to. I could go around the room, and I could ask you, give me a piece of music that really hits you hard. And you'll say what that piece of music is, and I'll say, why? You won't give a complete explanation. I can't give a complete explanation. We can give partial explanations, but these objects always have something mysterious about them. I can't explain why the first 4 minutes of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, I don't have words for it. Okay, I'd say only a genius could have done that. But that doesn't explain very much. But the thing is, I want to hear people talk about it. I want to hear more about Wagner. I want to hear more about that myth. I want to hear more about the Tristan chord. Okay, I like the analysis, a good analysis of it. That doesn't exhaust my experience, but I like it. I'm drawn to that kind of study. That's really the foundation of the humanities. I mean, that's what they rest upon. That's why we care about it. That's why the outside world, us academics, we make this our career. Why do people care what we do? Why are they interested in what we teach, what we say about these things? Because they respect them too. Okay? They feel this for certain works as well. And one of our jobs as teachers is to refine and cultivate that capacity for that kind of experience. Okay? To lead students into more developed, more educated, deeper experiences of those objects. And the thing is, for you to have that experience, one, it can't be mixed. You can't look at that painting of the raft of the Medusa while you got the buds in and you're listening to the music. Okay? It's a single tasking process. I mean, partly that's for cognitive reasons, but also just for distraction reasons. The attention has to be complete. You have to clear out all the other distractions. Museums generally are quiet places. Okay? You walk into them. They're temples for contemplation. The root of contemplation is temple. So you can't have multiple streams going. Multitasking doesn't work with the aesthetic experience of the object. The object itself can be multiple. But you can't have other external things happening. You have to slow down. Okay? You have to pause. You can't just rush through the museum and have that experience. You have to be able to let your mind pause and give it full attention. The stimulation need has to go down. You're absorbed. You know, the great aesthetician on this, Immanuel Kant, talks about this as a form of full absorption in that thing. You can't be thinking about something you have to do, a place you have to go. You can't be hungry. I'm really hungry. It's hard to have that kind of experience if you're really hungry. Right? Now, you can see what I'm getting at, and I think you can all... I'm going to wrap it up quickly so that we have a lot of time for discussion. But you can see, you've all had that kind of experience. You see a moment in a film, you know, the last 3 minutes of Charlie Chaplin's City Lights. It's going to stick with you, right? Or the music that you've had. You know these experiences yourselves, and I think you know that. The habituation of this capacity, okay? First of all, this is one of the achievements of your humanity. Okay? Young people here, the humanitas, going back to Cicero and others in the ancient world, is what are those things that we are capable of that distinguishes us from animals? What makes us human? Animals don't have aesthetic experiences. They don't know beauty, right? This is one of the things that we can do. This is the flourishing of ourselves. And you want to be able to, the young people here, you want to cultivate that, okay? This should be part of your formation. You know, the French word for education, formation. You're forming yourself to have these capacities. This should be a goal for all of you in the course of your higher education. My taste, my sensibility when I was 18, when I got here, is going to be different from what it is when I leave here. This is my growth, right? My Bildung in German. So you see the obvious next step, the digital habits. Not necessarily, but generally, this is just the way they fall in, of constant communication, constant stimulation, constant flashing images, the pace of digital-based consumption when you're online, when you're browsing. Ask the web designers that you know how quickly people hit pages and then leave. You know, the technology that we have now, marketers who are looking at banner ads and things like this, it's amazing how quickly the eyes and fingers race through this. Years of this, years of text messaging, 150 text messages a day, which is not unusual. That's just a little above the average. Okay, years of doing this grooves the habit for speed, acceleration, shallows, that is contrary to that fundamental humanistic experience of beautiful things. And that this is a deep threat to the humanities. We have to prime people for an experience that allows them to engage in our classes where they undertake the critical understanding of these things. So I'll stop there. That gives things to think about. Okay.
Mark, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to have a chance to respond to your comments tonight and your book. And thank you, Mike, for the invitation. I know this is an evening about the humanities, which is text-based, but by now you may be craving an image. So I'm going to give you one. About 2008 is when Mark released his book. And around the same time, in the fall of a given school year, this ad arrived in my mailbox. Do more stuff at school this year. Of course, the photo is already quite dated. Most strikingly absent is a smartphone. Our world, where Android phones can sell 1 billion units in a year, as was the case last year, or Apple can sell 75 million units of just its latest model in one quarter, like they did last quarter, would have been hard for most of us to imagine back then. Three nights ago, I was in this very room with Residence Life staff. We were conducting group interviews for our community advisor applicants, the student leaders who live on residence hall floors across campus. Our first activity took the form of speed dating. Students would rotate around the room and have 60 seconds to answer a question posed by a staff member. Thinking ahead to our time with Mark tonight, I asked students to name the activity on any of their digital devices that most frequently tempted them to waste time, and then to describe how their lives might be different if this temptation were no longer available. The most common answer? Netflix. One young student said to me, "It's not just the time spent watching shows. We then end up talking about them when we're together later on." I see some knowing nods from students. In addition to Netflix, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat were common contenders. And what would our students do if more of these temptations were gone? Overwhelmingly, they said they would study more, sleep more, and spend more time face-to-face with people. I can't help but wonder what that would do for retention, to say nothing of the humanities. In 1925, Woodrow Wilson observed that the real intellectual life of a body of undergraduates, if there be any, manifests itself not in the classroom, but in what they do and talk of and set before themselves as their favorite objects between classes and lectures. Has a generation ever had more opportunity to set before themselves unhelpful objects between classes and lectures? Wilson presumably has in view the daylight hours between class and lectures, but in 2015, students' online activity peaks on our campus, like many others, between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. And if you look at the data, Netflix is streaming like you wouldn't believe. Given the scope of our challenges, it's easy to become discouraged. But I've taken some hope recently in pondering a question posed by the Australian philosopher John Anderson. Anderson insists that we should not ask what end or purpose a social institution serves, but rather what conflicts take place within it. The point being, of course, that by understanding the conflicts, one might begin to imagine anew the ends and purposes that are now most pressing. They might be different than, or in addition to, those historically envisioned. Thanks to Mark, we have clear insight into what has been a slowly emerging but now powerfully present conflict for educational institutions. Screens are everywhere, ready to distract us. But the conflict is deeper than that, as Sarah, the name I'll give her, revealed in her prompt response to my speed dating questions. "What activity most distracts you?" I asked. "Oh my goodness, Instagram. How'd your life be different without it?" "I'd read more. I used to love to read." I used to love to read. The sad confession of a first-year student. The conflict we face, though we call it distraction, is really at its root about conflicting loves or desires. The love for learning that liberal arts schools have long aspired to nurture is facing overwhelming competition. The objects of our digital devotion are always on, increasingly wearable, and regularly beckoning for our attention. But Sarah's love for reading, like all our loves, is fostered in certain conditions and will inevitably atrophy in others. The pressing question in this conflict, of course, is which loves or desires will prevail? How will things go for Sarah over the next 3.5 years? I believe that Mark's research and writing in this vein is well complemented by the recent work of James K.A. Smith in Imagining the Kingdom. Smith argues that educators have, for far too long, assumed that the most fundamental thing about a person is what he or she believed. Because of this, education is focused largely on the transmission of knowledge. But Smith argues that our desires are more basic and generally compel us more than our beliefs. How then are desires formed? Smith's answer in a nutshell is that our repeated embodied experiences inevitably shape what we come to care about. Smith argues that social orders recruit us by conscripting our individual bodies through mundane means. Repeated postures, cadences, rituals implant a habitus in us over time so that our bodies come to know or sense things that are often outside of our conscious awareness. Such pedagogies are effective, Smith insists, precisely because they work outside of our conscious awareness. They are cunning in that they teach and shape us even when, and perhaps especially when, we haven't signed up to be taught. Now let's consider a contrasting picture from the 40s. This is a residence hall room from EMU in the 40s. Wouldn't have been far from the location we're now in. The old administration building housed residence hall rooms, and I think Ken Nafziger is here, and this is his father. Ken's father is reading his Bible, as are the other two men. There was overcrowding this year, so they moved in a double bed over here so that all three men would have a place to sleep. When Ken's dad sat at his desk in college, it wasn't for the first time, of course, that he sat at a desk. His body knew what was coming. He was there to read or study or perhaps solve some challenging math homework. It may have been hard work, but his environment was suited to the task, and his work would likely lead to the natural rewards. When our 2008 student from the previous slide sits down at his desk, has his body made a decision, so to speak, to study? Does his very being, through the rhythms and rituals of gathering his books and sitting at his desk, anticipate the richly rewarding labors of learning? This doesn't seem likely. He opens his computer, and even if he succeeds in studying for an hour, such a feat probably involved fending off distractions numerous times. How many notifications did he get while he sat there? How many ads vied for his attention while he tried to do his research? The real clincher in all of this, though, is that, as Smith would argue, is that this student has likely been formed by his repeated experience to not only expect distractions, but in some ways at least to desire them. He never signed up for a course to become an easily distracted college student, to have his interests continually divided. Yet his body, in its natural digital habitat, has been conscripted into just the sort of training that shapes him in this way. It's a rare student in our world today who hasn't been so formed. But all is not lost. Perhaps such cunning pedagogies could work for the benefit of the humanities instead of against them. Such a turnaround would require educators and mentors to engage in new and oftentimes old ways. In The Betrayal of the Mentors, one of the last chapters of The Dumbest Generation, Bauerlein writes, "As young people forge their personalities in an uncertain world, they skirt one of the customary means of doing so. That is, acquainting themselves with the words and images and truths and beauties of the past. And nobody tells them that they have overlooked anything. Nobody telling them that they have overlooked anything is, of course, the essence of the mentor's betrayal. But how might mentors re-engage in a hyper-connected digital world? It would have to include multifaceted pedagogy, one that immersed our students and ourselves in different rhythms and rituals, conscripting us, even sometimes without our realizing it, into practices that nurture a love for the good, the true, and the beautiful." By way of one example, Christendom College, just a little to the north, has some deeply ingrained rhythms in their mutual life together, which it seems to me could well provide the kind of deep connections and engagement with big questions that many of us would envy for our own school. Their regularly scheduled chapels occur just before the noon meal so that faculty and students can enjoy eating together following corporate worship. Imagine a community that has woven together worship and the word with fellowship and food while conversing about worthy questions. Students and mentors breaking bread together and discussing ideas far more enduring than the latest full season marathon stream from Netflix. This is but one example of communal rhythms and rituals which could embed members into their social context in such a way that their loves and desires are reordered. What could we imagine for our common life here? I don't have time to share other ideas, but I would love nothing more than to dream together with many of you about the re-engagement of the mentors. We could call it ROM, kind of ironic. Young people don't know ROM, read-only memory. Okay. A peace-loving tradition such as ours certainly has resources to withstand dominant cultural norms. And in recent years, we took on the issue of environmental sustainability with success, integrating it into our curriculum and discussing it in our water cooler conversations. In that case, we named the problem and then worked collectively to change not only what our students thought about related ideas, but also how they would embody new commitments. Living in LEED-certified buildings and sorting food waste at the end of each meal are merely two of many ways we've impacted the rhythms and rituals of our students. We keep sustainability before them. Shall we not invest comparable passion in nurturing a sustainable university climate for the healthy formation of our students' loves and desires? The secular liturgies that conspire to shape our students have no bounds. At a residential school like EMU, we could creatively expand our classrooms to include the residence halls, the athletic fields, the dining hall, chapel, and countless other places with the aspiration of impacting not just what students know, but what they actually come to love. If we name the conflict, harness our collective energy to resist some trends and encourage others, we might see Sarah and many students like her graduate from EMU with a deep love for reading and for learning generally.
Thank you, Mark and Eric, an auspicious group I'm amongst this evening. I want to talk about something related, but tangential, coming at this from the fine arts as being different than the humanities. And I want to talk about boredom. But first, I want to talk about Pinocchio. We all know the story of Pinocchio, the puppet that was created by a lonely man who wanted a son. And so he created a wooden boy, and Pinocchio ran away from home and acted badly. And what did Pinocchio do? Back a little bit from here. What did Pinocchio do? He ate bad food, he played games, and he got involved in eternal stimulation of a non-quality sort. What happened to Pinocchio? He turned into a donkey. And why a donkey? What do we know about donkeys? They're stubborn, not very bright, easily led, even though they can be stubborn, easily manipulated. I think that what the story of Pinocchio is talking about, or at least I can twist it in this particular area, is the idea that the constant diet of shallow and nutritionless stimulation turns us all into donkeys. Now, you know, there was a donkey that bore Jesus to his destinations. There's good donkeys as well, but this is not the donkey that we see in Pinocchio. So anyway, hold that in mind, donkeys. We're going to talk about food and animals tonight. Since I'm in theater, obviously I'm talking about food and animals, since you always try to avoid animals on stage because they always upstage you and act better than the human actors. So it doesn't make sense. But what is important for our discussion this evening is the mindless and exclusive consumption of non-nutritive input and the lack of space for reflection and boredom, and therefore creative generation, which is exactly what Mark was talking about earlier. So I'm on the right track. So, a disclaimer. When my kids tell me they're bored, I say to them, that demonstrates a lack of imagination. And I think I'm right and also wrong. So we're going to use that as a structure. I also make my kids eat healthy food and boring food and encourage their creativity through that. So this is going to, I'm going to use my motherhood as an example, because besides the work I do in the classroom and the stage, it takes up most of my time, certainly a great deal of my energy. So, first of all, I want to talk about boredom itself, and this is the part where I was right as a mom in saying that boredom is not about embracing your creative side because you're looking for something to stimulate you. In theater, we view phone books. We don't use phone books anymore, do we? When you talk about it used to be in the old days when I was young, when you talked about an actor that was really good, you said, I could listen to them read the phone book. I could listen to Benedict Cumberbatch read the phone book. Katie is nodding her head enthusiastically. Right. Did you know that he's named after a character from Shakespeare? All right. Hold that. All right. So, we have established that phone books are boring. And if you listen to NPR like I do while I'm cooking dinner, there's a connection here, you've heard about the studies about boredom. This recent work that's come out from a couple of researchers, let me get their names here, Sandy Mann and Rebecca Cadman from England, they found that people who engaged in boring activities demonstrated greater creativity. And guess what boring activity they subjected them to? Reading the phone book. Not only did they make them read the phone book, but they made them copy numbers out of the phone book and then tested their creativity. And how did they test their creativity? They gave them a paper cup and said, think of all the ways you can use this paper cup or what you can do with this paper cup. And people that were involved in interesting activities didn't have near as many ideas about how to use that paper cup as the people who read the phone book. So, boredom, from their conclusions, is very useful in generating creativity and creative generation. So Dr. Mann, one of the authors of this phone book study, commented in Inc. magazine that boredom at work has always been seen as something to be eliminated, but perhaps we should be actually embracing it in order to increase our creativity. So when we have to go to faculty meetings and sit there and be bored, not that they're ever boring. I was on sabbatical last semester. I didn't have to go to a faculty meeting. Anyway, what happens is your mind has space to sort of settle down and just exist for a while, or even contemplate or reflect. In order to have the aesthetic experience that we've been talking about or thinking about tonight, we need time to just be bored and let things percolate in our brain. So I'm going to offer to you that not only are we cutting ourselves off from deep reflection by using our digital devices, but we are cutting ourselves from the simple act of being bored. My children say to me a lot less now than they used to that they're bored because they all have iPhones. They're all teenagers. They've all entered that age. So let's talk about boredom as rice and beans. So good, basic, complete protein. Not very interesting. Basic, just by itself, rice and beans. So a meal of rice and beans is boring, but it feeds all of our nutritional needs. So how do we move it to the next step? We've established that boredom can be useful, but how do we add some sauce to our rice and beans? Think about it in this way, that an idle mind always needs or creates a toy. Think about that. An idle mind always creates a toy. So I'm going to go really old school here and do a handout. But I didn't bring enough because there's a great group. So I'm going to pass them out. You can rip it in half. They're just circles. You can rip it in half and share it with the person next to you. If you didn't bring a pen because, I don't know, you have a device that you're taking notes on, you can't do it. But share them. As this comes around to you, this is an exercise that I have used in my theater classes for decades. You will notice when it comes to you that I drew them freehand. These are not circles generated on a computer. They're not even. They're not complete. They're just circles. And they have a great degree of boredom inherent in them. This is very similar to the paper cup experiment. These circles need to be created into something. You need to bring your mind to these circles and use them to make something different. So I'm afraid this experiment is bound to fail because you have not experienced any boredom this evening. Thank you, Mark and Eric. So you're not going to be terribly creative. But nonetheless, play with your circles as we continue. So what you're going to do is just, well, do anything you want with them. This is also very useful in classes where you have learners that like to doodle while they're listening. So the obvious one would be like a smiley face or a sunshine or, I'm not going to give any more hints because then that takes it off your list of things that are possible. So anyway, as we continue in the next couple of minutes while I finish up what I'm saying here, and as you ask questions, you can continue to add things to your circles. All right. So this is where I move to the part where I'm wrong when I say to my kids that, or not completely right, let's put it that way, because I'm never wrong as a mom, right? Where I tell my kids that boredom is a lack of imagination. That isn't a negative. Boredom is a very useful stage in which to move towards creativity. They're leaving already. Am I boring you? Oh, darn. All right. So embracing boredom and moving away from a constant need for stimulation, a constant need for consumption, and a constant need for connection. Creativity is defined as the use of the imagination or original ideas, the ability to make new things or think of new ideas. This is all what we're all about, right? We're all about innovation. We've got to make new things. We've got to create new ideas. We need to revolutionize the world. We were talking about at dinner the desire to invent the new Tumblr, the new Yik Yak, the new whatever that's going to make us a million, because that's the way we're going to get to be a millionaire by the age of 25. It's not through anything else. So this is what we are all after, is creativity. Oh, I'm so glad I'm seeing tops of heads as you're working on your circles. Very good. Very good. So we're moving from boredom to creativity. We're moving from boredom space into the potential for aesthetic experience. And this is where I want to connect directly into what Mark shared with us this evening. This idea that I wrote down, and these were not his words, but I think it was really, this is my interpretation, the habituation of capacity for aesthetic experience. And I think that is only accessed through the ability to sit and not have anything going on in your brain until it does, because that's what we do. Is we fill in the empty space. But if there's no empty space to fill in, then we can't fill anything in. So what I'm asking you all to do or to think about is moderation. So I Googled moderation as I was preparing this because that's how we do it. And I got the normal one, you know, Oscar Wilde saying moderation in everything, even in moderation and all those. But then I also got this guy who he has no bio. I don't love those things when you pull quotes out about people and you have no idea who they are. He has not written a book. But he said something cool about moderation, or purportedly. He said, the ideas are louder when there are fewer of them. I'm just going to leave you with that. Thank you. Oh, one more. A student about 6 years ago bought me this bumper sticker. It's going to be offensive, so close your eyes if you're going to be offended. But a student bought me this bumper sticker in Washington, D.C., and this is really my last word.
Quiet question?
Yes, sir.
I'm looking back through history for a transition like the sort of transition we're seeing now with the emergence of digital social media. And, you know, Socrates complained about writing as a pharmacon. The humanities depend on the existence of writing. Socrates was like, actually, that's going to really damage memory. It's going to bring about a general lack of wisdom. I can no longer hear the voices of my daemon because, you know, if you're writing, you basically are so focused and narrowly focused that you're not open to the ground of being or whatever to your daemon anymore. So it seems, I mean, I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here because I'm a writing instructor, so I'm very sympathetic. I see what's happening to the students. But isn't this sort of a recapitulation? I mean, students, you know, there were shallow, callow students back in the university system in the high Middle Ages. You know, they were complaining about how shallow the students were back in ancient Greece.
I think that the digital age would be characterized in terms of these problems as aggravating. It's not a whole new qualitative problem here. I think that, text messaging. Students can write notes. They used to pass notes around and things like that. And in one sense, it's just that we've raised the capacity exponentially so that you can get a picture and you don't pass it to the next person. You can canvas the whole high school with that picture within a few minutes. And about the Socrates issue, I think that Socrates, of course, he overlooked all the benefits of writing, but I think he was right about one aspect of that, and that is that when we can write something down, we don't have to remember it. And I hear students say, why should I know the Gettysburg Address? I can always retrieve it. I can always pull it up. And my response is, but the Gettysburg Address and other great orations in American history. I Have a Dream and the Atlanta Compromise speech, these should be part of you. It should be living knowledge in you. You should have the cadences of the world will little note but not long remember, the little note nor long remember what we say here but it cannot forget what they did here. That should be part of your sensibility. It should help form who you are. So by letting people think that these materials are always available because we can record them, we can pull them up, it just becomes information. It's not the living word. That's in the translation I saw. The living word. It's the dead letter. So that's I give Socrates some. I agree with him on the identification of that particular problem, and that it has this current form. But yeah, you want
to? Oh,
if you want to comment. I mean, yeah. This isn't new, and teenage. I say the dumbest generation. I was a teenager, and I didn't want to talk to any grown-ups. I didn't want to hang around my parents. I couldn't stand them. And I was 16. The way you don't want to. I didn't want to have to listen to Walter Cronkite drone on about Watergate. I didn't care about those things, but I couldn't check out. I couldn't go like this under the table. I didn't have another TV to go to and turn on Saved by the Bell. Or something like that. So I was sort of this forced exposure. But if it was there, believe me, I would have gone. I'd be like this, or all the time.
So historically, there's always been a mature culture acting as an attractor to pull young people into adulthood, and now
more or less. And remember, adolescence is a new stage. There was no such thing as adolescence in 1850. In 1900, in America, the percentage of high school age Americans who were in high school was about 10%. The vast majority of kids left school fourth, fifth, sixth grade. You learn to read and write and do arithmetic, and you know some of the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address? You're ready to go to work. So you work on the family farm, you work in the store, you work in sewing circles, you work as delivery boys. Most of them were working. They had no social life when they were 15. They might see, you know, other kids, after church or something, but they were under the direct guidance and control, for the most part, of grown-ups. It was only over the course of the 20th century when more and more high school teenagers stayed in school through high school, and then we put them into 1,000 kids 190 days a year for 8 hours a day in blocks of 25, moving them from room to room. They're studying together, they're eating together, they're going to gym class together, they have clubs after school and athletics together. That's when youth culture started. That's when we got movies like Rebel Without a Cause, where you know, that's when people started saying, I don't understand kids these days. That's when we had, in the 50s, sort of youth music. Frank Sinatra, in 1940, was for teenagers and for 50-year-olds. You had a wide age range. What would you think if you were 18 in 1962, and some 60-year-old said, "Hey, I really like the Beatles." You think, no, it's ours. That's for young people. Well, what's the line in the Who song? Talking about my generation. Don't try to dig what we all say, right? The youth movement came along. You're old people. That's when we got the generation gap, as it was called. So. The conditions are there for were developed well before the digital age for this intensification of peer pressure, of youth culture, because youths were in these compact spaces much more, and so all the tribalisms of adolescence begun. I mean, it would probably the same thing would happen if you put 1,050-year-olds in a building like this. You get the same kind of social dynamics being created. So, anyway, I'll shorten my responses. Yes, ma'am.
I think I may be the oldest person here. I'm Heather Beggs. I'm a retired English teacher and editor. And I graduated from high school in 1960. And we had American Bandstand. We came home to that. Was certainly all teenagers, and
but wasn't that only one day a week?
No, it was several days a week. And we were further intellectually stimulated by combinations of Howdy Doody for our younger brothers and sisters, and lots of things like Hopalong Cassidy and the Lone Ranger, et cetera, et cetera. And our parents thought we had gone down the tubes.
The Lone Ranger didn't have teenagers, did it?
Mm-hmm. No, but that's what we were watching. We were glued to this, and the parents were trying to get to their channels for things, and it was in the afternoon when we came home from school, et cetera. Yeah. So.
Okay. Yes?
Well, I was 30 when your book came out, so I feel almost morally obligated to speak for the under 30 generation with a question that might open this up a bit. Because I certainly want to echo and experience what you say about distraction and about the need for boredom, for creativity. But I'm also very interested in this focus on the new youth culture that is so immersive and so involved. And the idea that maybe you are experiencing something that has never been experienced in quite this way before. Now, I don't, and I never did go home to watch Saved by the Bell, but recently on Facebook, because I'm old and I don't use Instagram, or old for this generation, I accessed a BuzzFeed article that was a collection of memes of Saved by the Bell hooks. And nobody's laughing. it was a really interesting cultural vision of pop culture and criticism. And there was some really interesting content creation happening. And it was probably created by somebody in this generation. And so I wonder what cultural and aesthetic opportunities we miss. I'm not saying we should turn away from the past, and I love that reminder. And I think we need that reminder all the more these days. But what aesthetic opportunities are just burgeoning in this new culture that we haven't seen before?
Yeah, I think that we should recognize that has to happen, and that we want to prompt that to happen. What facilitates that, I think, is that we have some tension between the generations. When I chide the young, the point is not to punish or simply to rebuke. You want to provoke, right? You want to stand up for you want to be the elder, offering the criticism, the stern admonition. And what you want is for the young to respond to that in an active and critical way. So, I get a lot of emails from young people, and I respond to every one. The best thing that happens is when I have to say to a youngster, you're right, I overplayed that point. Right? You win that one. You've shown me something, or you revealed something there that and so what you would say is that, well, the general thing. For an old guy like me, my job is to be the critic. You know, I've got a 9-year-old. We've got a culture war going on all the time. And he argues back. You know, I say, would you pick your battles? You don't have to argue every time. But the idea is that you want a creative and critical
back and forth between old and young. We criticize, you respond, and you say, you know, you're a little too grooved. You're a little not aware of what's a lot of things going on right now. And you say, and we say, yeah, right. I'm sure you're doing amazing things. And you say, yeah, let me show you this. That kind of back and forth is generative. I think that's a healthy thing in a society. The unhealthy thing is when there is tepid or just lack of interest. I mean, if you look at the youth movement of the 1960s, okay, there was a lot of ridiculousness in that, but there was a lot of intelligence as well. If you read something called the Port Huron Statement, which was this kind of programmatic statement by the Students for a Democratic Society, it's a very intelligent and sophisticated document. And I'll tell you something about those early protesters. They couldn't stop criticizing the elders. They were obsessed with the establishment. They were constantly launching arguments against the older generation. And then you had older generations, some of them arguing back and criticizing the young. Something unfortunate happened in that too many of the older generation gave up on that creative engagement and mutual criticism. But I think that is one of the reasons why the youth movement of the 1960s was a lasting historical phenomenon, because it was critically engaged with the old ones, and the old ones, most of them. It was a vibrant thing until the older generation gave up, and the 70s just relinquished that role of criticizing the young. And I get a lot of anger in response because I do. I say, you know, if your musical tastes are the same, you guys here, you're 19. If your musical tastes are the same when you're 29, something hasn't happened that should have happened. Now, we're uncomfortable with that because we don't want to criticize people for having vulgar taste. We don't want to say you are crude, you're unrefined. That sounds elitist, it sounds snobbish. We should have a lot more of that. That's my cultural bias here. But I hear very few of my generation taking that step. So, yes, sir. No, yes, ma'am. And then, sir. Yes.
Well, as you were speaking about the social peer-to-peer culture and the idea of distraction and not being absorbed and having that aesthetic experience, made me think a lot about gaming. And you didn't speak about gaming and the youth culture in gaming.
Yeah.
And I see my children completely absorbed for hours in gaming, and that gaming creates a problem-solving networks in their minds, and they have to cooperate with other players in online gaming, and they're not doing anything else. They're not texting or interacting, but they're problem-solving. And a lot, I'm a K-12 educator, and a lot of education now, online education, is going into a gaming model. So rather than a contemplative, be bored, look and have the experience, students are immediately rewarded for getting the right answer. So that game model is how students are learning the aesthetic now. So I'm just wondering, how does gaming fit into what you're talking about in terms of how absorbing that is for students in a digital environment?
You're right, and some psychologists call it slow time. Slow time is when you get immersed in an activity, 3 hours go by, and you think it was 45 minutes. Right? That could happen in a lot of things. Reading for some people, writing for some people. Gaming, it is different. This is why people can game for 8 hours. You know, it doesn't feel like 8 hours. They don't think that 8 hours have gone by. And certainly, you get the intense concentration on that game. I'm not a cognitive psychologist, and then haven't studied the games, but I hold. I just suspend my judgment about the value of gaming until we see concrete evidence that the gaming hours have produced better writing, better reading, better. We know that there's better spatial development, spatial understanding. The Air Force uses gaming to develop pilots, but I'm waiting for some broad educational achievement gains, which we certainly don't see in any of the language skills. Verbal skills are going down for high school students. The SAT out of the writing exam in 2005. Since 2006, scores have gone down every year, except for 2 years when they were flat. Now people are doing more writing than ever before. Young people have never written so much in human history as they are now. But when it comes time to the kind of writing we want to see in college, it's worse. There is an increasing number of students who have to be placed into remediation, writing remediation. Yes, ma'am. Quick.
But are they then showing their knowledge and understanding in a different way by the collaboration and using the media tools that they have, where writing isn't enough for them anymore, because they don't have the visual and the sound that they can. Yes, I agree, because I'm a writing teacher, I'm a composition teacher, so I see it, but it's they've learned to express their learning and their aesthetic in other richer ways than they can achieve with the pencil and paper.
That could be. I would love it if employers started saying, we're getting great people coming in, young people coming into our workplaces. And in college, remediation, we shouldn't have to do remediation. Remediation means students aren't ready for college-level work. It didn't happen in 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. That's why you don't get college credit for remedial courses. And it's a huge burden on higher education, so we could bring that down. But I think, gaming gets a lot of kids onto things that they wouldn't in books. Yeah. I hope so. Yeah.
I just wanted to comment a bit on what you said about education and building and formation and the role of mentors. I get to teach a class with incoming international students. And one of the exercises we do is have them make I am statements, because I am statements, when completed, show either an attribute or they show a connection with people. And so some will say, I am a student, or I am a son or daughter, and that's more of a collectivistic response. And others will say, I am smart, which is an adjective and an attribute. So you can distinguish between more individualistic students and those from more collectivistic cultures by that exercise. The interesting thing is that what's been changing recently is more and more of the international students are coming in displaying more of the individualistic types of responses. And when I've asked them about that, particularly the ones from Kenya, have responded that, well, when I was growing up, my parents always talked about the quiet time in the evening, sitting and listening to the stories and the oral tradition and having that time to listen. But now when I go home, we've skipped having landlines and we all have cell phones. And so now we're on our cell phones with our friends and we no longer have the oral transmission and the education from the elders. And now I don't even really know my grandparents in the same way.
So my question is,
is the abandonment of the mentors not so much an abandonment, but an ignoring? The mentors want to be there, but they're being ignored because the students are coming home now, connecting with their peers in the evening on their cell phones, and everything is individualized as opposed to sitting in the collective and hearing that together.
That makes sense to me, and a lot of the activities are self-display. right? What is the original motto of YouTube? Anyone know? It used to be up right there in the corner. First of all, YouTube.
Broadcast yourself.
Right? Or the selfie. I mentioned at dinner, 50% of all the pictures on Instagram done by young people are selfies. They're not pictures of someone else, they're pictures of me. So the Facebook page, tell us about you. Give all your attributes and everything. So I think that a lot of just the habits of social media are, first, I'm presenting me to others, and I hope they respond. You know, I want them to look at me and to appreciate me. But what you say certainly it makes sense. And a lot of the parents are doing this too. How many restaurants do you go to? The whole family is, you know, on their own. And you know, it's a babysitter for you know, single parents. Got to cook dinner.
Everyone's babysitter now.
It's so yeah. So,
hours and days.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am. And then yes, ma'am.
I'm not sure I understand this so much as a condemnation of the dumbest generation, but a lack of parenting. That there was a time when sitting a child in front of a television, the electronic babysitter was looked down on. That was bad parenting. But now you're a great parent if you supply your kid with every piece of technology, and people are using those to entertain their children and babysit their children. And I see I'm sure everyone here has seen very young children using tablets and phones, and we're concerned that this is a factor in the increasing autism rate.
Look, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends 1 hour of TV per day, and that it be educational television. Actually, 0 hours up until
two.
Up until two. Okay. After that, 1 hour. 1 hour a day. And they don't like SpongeBob. Reports come out. SpongeBob talks too fast. That was one of the findings of it. TV remains the most popular leisure activity for the young, even this digital age. It hasn't pulled much away from TV time. And the thing is, the TV's on. While I'm texting and reading text, the TV's on. I heard a student the other day say in my class, when I said, you know, there are studies that show if you do your homework while the TV's on, retention goes down. Common sense. And the student says, if I turn this TV off, the silence would drive me crazy. So, I mean, there's loneliness. Young people take a walk. I've got to think of someone to call. The solitude is too much. I'm lonely. I'm 19 years old. I'm here in college. I'm away from my friends in high school. It's a new world. I'm not home. I'm lonely. And it's a horrible feeling. This is a way to. But so what we ought to do is one of the attributes of growing up is learning to be alone. Right? Being alone is something that it should be cultivated, not escaped. So. Robert Frost. Read some Robert Frost poems. Okay. And lonely as it is, that loneliness will be more lonely ere it will be less. Yeah. Oh, no, ma'am, yes. And then, sir.
I'm curious why you chose to focus purely on the under 30s when it comes to some of this technology, because I would argue that many of the people in my life that are the greatest abusers of technology are in my parents' generation, that I'm the one, or we're the ones telling them, can you put our phones down at dinner, or why is this out of the table? Or
I'm a baby boomer. When I was young, we blamed the old people. Now that I'm old, we gotta blame the young people.
But did you look at that? As natives to this digital age, in many ways, we've also learned the rules of how to use it. And for other generations, they're learning how to use it almost like you would a new language, whereas for us, it's
Well, I think that's a fair question. It could be just because I'm a college teacher, so I'm watching students, and my main interest is in education. So, 40-year-olds, no, they're it's over. So, and 50, you know, me in my 50s, So, I think that's just, that was just my experience, and look, most of things like reading, it's pretty rare for someone who was not a reader as a kid to become a reader at age 40. I mean, it happens, but it's rare. In fact, it's rare for a kid who's 5 years old and is not read to a lot to become a reader at age 10. It really has to start in early years. And the sad fact is that it's almost over at kindergarten. When you've got a big vocabulary gap in kindergarten, mainly because of parents reading to a child or not reading, or talking to a child or not talking, I mean, meaningful conversation with a child, what happens in school is the reading gap, I mean, a non-read-to kid goes to kindergarten with a 2,000-word working vocabulary. A read-to child, a 5,000-word working vocabulary. Here's what happens with the reading gap. Okay, it's the Matthew effect, reading researchers call it. The more you have, the more you shall be given. So, I think it was just, this is the crucial time for this. Yes, sir. And then yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Yeah, responding to the other person, I confess that I've watched too much Netflix. But anyway,
we all slum
I was in a conversation a few weeks ago with my pastor, who's quite young, and I mentioned liking The Shallows, and said he should read it sometime, and he did, and so it showed up in the sermon this past Sunday, and it was excellent. And so I said, you really liked that book too, didn't you? And he said, well, actually, I didn't read the book because he had, you know, and he told us during the sermon that he had 30 tabs or open, you know, and he read an article, but his wife was reading the book. And okay. The sermon was really good, but I did wonder if he was undermining himself a little bit, you know, because he talked about the book.
You know, it's not a hard read. I mean, Nick writes very well. It's not long. No footnote, or very little footnote.
Okay, good. Yeah, yes, ma'am.
So you talked about having ascetic experiences. I'm so glad that you could finally put that into words for me, because I really resonated with that, especially when it comes to music. But I'm also a student of literature, and I was wondering how do we cultivate that? What does that look like? Is it mostly a thing that happens in the classroom with professors who say, here's what you should be reading so you can have just a better general understanding? Or is it something that happens mostly outside the classroom where students are taking their own initiative to seek out those opportunities?
Well, it's both. It's both. I mean, you want to, first of all, I used to be an all great books guy, you know, only the classics, and I think that's a mistake. Just read a lot. Always have a book that you're reading, and find series of books that really, really grab you. You know, the Bernard Cornwell, who wrote these 19 or 15 historical novels about Sharp, who's a soldier in Wellington's army from 1799 through 1815, a series of battles. You know, it's adventure stuff, but I they're great. Or the Travis McGee novels of John D. MacDonald. These just volume reading, I think is very important. And then ask your teachers, give me a few things that I should read and take slow. And it might even be, why don't you say, all right, I'm going to memorize two poems a week. Memorization, now that'll slow you down, right? To memorize something really slows you down. You have to get into character. You've got to get the cadences. You know, an Emily Dickinson poem is easy to memorize. They're short. They have regular meter and rhyme. But you've got to imagine that figure speaking. But memorize a lot of poems, and just have them. You know, you can wrap them off in cocktail parties and impress people. reminds me of Emily Dickinson's poem on the winter afternoon light. is a little Shakespeare. That's what I would say. A lot of popular fun reading books, and have it by your bed every night. Look forward to say, you know what? I can't wait. And the day's over, phone's off, computer's done, I find this relaxing, enjoyable, and it's all mine, right? This is me in this world. For kids, I just try to read with my son an hour a night. Right? Read with him for an hour a night. Sometimes I'll read to him for 45 minutes, and then I'll say, "All right, you got to read your own book." No, you keep reading, Dad. I'm doing my Legos. So that's his demand. But just an hour of book time a night to develop the habit. I mean, he looks forward to it. It's the ritual. And there's an emotional factor for him. There's an end of the day. Okay, things have happened. It's quieter now, and this is before we lay me down to sleep. That plants the value in those books. So you ask your teachers for titles. You know, I'll have a big class, and I'll say, all right, look, we're almost at the end, we're almost to summer, so let's go around the room, and why don't you give us just, each one of you give the three books that you want to read over the next month of summer vacation. And they all get very frightened looks on their faces, because none of them have any books that they have selected. So letting them know, you should have your own reading agenda. And again, it doesn't have to be the classics. Get some of those in there, but... Have your own program of reading, and it's your own thing. Yes, sir.
So then, I'm going to go back to the punish, rebuke, provoke. I've been in the classroom for a while, and part of what I've noticed with the transition, especially to smartphones, and I'm not a cognitive psychologist either, but I might call it something like affect attunement. It gets harder and harder for me to tell where my students are. They could be thrilled, rapt, or completely checked out, disgusted, or completely bewildered, and they would have the same flat persona on their face. Yeah. I have no clue what's going on inside their heads.
Yeah.
And that is a real challenge for me as an instructor because I don't know where you are, I don't know what you're thinking, I don't know if I need to slow down, I don't know if I need to speed up, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I've wondered if it's
the screen, you know, that I'm used to interacting with a screen now, I'm not used to interacting with faces. And
that's a
really
good that's a whole other issue, Okay.
I think that's a great provocative, evocative metaphor to think about as we leave. And I encourage you to stay around, talk to each other, and talk more to Mark, too. Thanks a lot. And let's give another thanks to Eric and Heidi for the terrific responses that they gave.